I'll give her cup and t-shirt right away. My name is Carol, and I am an alcoholic. I was taken by complete surprise and real pleasure to be asked to speak this morning. And I am nervous, and I'm really humbled to be asked to tell my story at the Red Road Convention. I first came to Albuquerque to live permanently on July 4th, and it'll be almost 11 years that I have been here. And my first group in Albuquerque, my first home group, was the Native American group. And I was welcomed so warmly there and received so much friendship and so much help and support in the program. It was just a wonderful experience. And doors of service have opened to me in the program here that I never would have expected to have had the opportunity for. I came from New York, and in New York, the areas are so large, I never even met a delegate. I had no idea, you know, who the DCM was. I mean, it was just, they were huge. And here I've gotten to know everyone else all over the state and area service so that, you know, I recognize faces of friends wherever I go. And that door opened when the Native American group allowed me to be the alternate GSR for them. Gilbert Shorty was the GSR and I was his shadow. And it's where I started to learn about service in New Mexico. And I was able to go on and be a district committee member, a DCM, for District 11, and then was the area secretary for 2 years. And that was a really challenging service job, which I have happily now handed on to someone else. But it was just great to be able to serve in that way. And it just, so much has happened to me in my life since I came to New Mexico. I mean, it has been 11 years of total adventure. And I was thinking, I was sitting there, you know, our life in the East Coast was very, very narrow. And our life here is just as broad as this big sky is out here. And things have happened to me that are so beyond my wildest dreams that, you know, the components to have dreamed them, you know, weren't even in my imagination. You know, just totally new experiences that I never expected to have in my life. I was born into one of those, you know, nice middle-class Anglo families on the East Coast. My father was in business, and our whole family life was structured to really hide the fact that he was an alcoholic. And I believe my mother was also. But our whole family life was structured around alcohol. Everything was around alcohol. And there were euphemisms for everything. So that when my father would come home from work, and he would refrain from drinking during the day, he had a very irresponsible job, he would refrain from drinking when he came home from work, and he began to drink, and my mother began to drink. You know, the whole day had been aimed toward having the house in order. She would get the dinner cooked and waiting on the stove. And then they would sit down and they would start to drink. And dinners were designed to be able to wait as long as needed for them to be able to drink the alcohol that they wanted to drink that night. And after dinner, I cleaned up, usually as I'm an only child, or my mother might have, and my father went to bed because he was so tired. Well, you know, what he did was he drank enough that he could make it through dinner and then go upstairs and pass out at about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, and then get up early and start this whole ritual life over again. All of their friends were very heavy drinkers, so their heavy drinking just went into the picture. No one ever mentioned their drinking as being problematic to them. And like the old story goes, you know, it's because my dad drank with all of his doctors. They'd never mention it to him because when they would go off duty, they would come to our house to get loaded. My father had a very well-stocked bar. They were gracious hosts. My mother cooked constantly. And people would come and party at our house. So doctors would never say anything. He drank with his lawyers. They would never have said anything. The business people that they made friends with were the heavy drinking business people. They said nothing. And our whole time, the only time really that our family sat down together, was when they were sitting down and drinking. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, the light bulb went on, the connection got made that I had the disease of alcoholism, it's like the second light bulb was, gee, my parents were alcoholics too. Because I'd listened to enough stories to understand what the symptoms were. And the third light bulb that went off was, I have been raised on whiskey wisdom. No wonder I have had the problems I have had. Because that's when my parents taught me about life, was when they were three sheets to the wind and recounting the wisdom they had accrued through life. And I thought to myself, I gotta grow up all over again. And thank God Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that opportunity. I mean, this has been my family. And this has been where I have learned from new sober fathers, new sober mothers, sober brothers and sisters about how to live life on life's terms. And what a difference that has made. This illness of alcoholism goes so far back on both sides of my family. I mean, you can't see the roots of it. I think they brought it with them when they came here, you know, hundreds more years ago. I think they brought it with them because it's always been there and it's very, very ingrained. And I realized right at the beginning that I was being given a gift of an opportunity to break this chain in my family, to speak out about this illness of alcoholism and the fact that it runs in our family, and to speak out enough about it that it can't go underground in denial again in our family. And what a difference that has made. You know, I'm here because, here in New Mexico, because, my daughter and her husband Ernest were expecting their first grandchild, and I thought, what am I staying in New York for when I've got a grandbaby going to be born in Albuquerque? So I moved out here, and, you know, and they are both in the program. My granddaughters have not seen me drunk. They have not seen their parents drunk. And my son has been able to abstain from alcohol and not have to see the disease develop in himself, because he realized he was never going to be a social drinker. Early on, it hit him that one would be too many and 1,000 would never be enough for him. And so he simply hasn't gotten in it. And they know about this illness. All the generations before, talented, caring, intelligent people in my family were cut off at the knees by the disease of alcoholism. One after another, they told me, when you look back on the family tree, if people don't say they're alcoholic, look for a situation where they talk about how wonderful the woman was, and they never mention the man. Well, I had one of those. I had a great-grandmother, had a hotel, ran a millinery shop, and raised 5 daughters. No mention of her husband. I'm sure he was the town drunk of Riverhead, Long Island. And she was a wonderful woman. And, you know, I just see the devastation that this disease causes in families. Right now, just by incredible circumstances of having initiated a move out to Estancia and having a job in Estancia open up, right as I was making my move out there, I'm working in the Torrance County Detention Facility, and I coordinate their mental health program. And right now, I will make a pitch for recruiting people to come and do corrections work, to have AA meetings at the Torrance County Detention Facility. And look for the other institutions that house federal inmates as well as state inmates, because there is an overrepresentation of Native Americans that are incarcerated. And I will stake my salary on the fact that it's due to the use and abuse of alcohol, and that the majority are there because of charges that they picked up while under the influence, because they might have thought it, but they wouldn't have done such an incredibly stupid thing had they been in their right mind. And they are not being reached with AA, and they need it so badly because they need that sober group to be with. One after another, they say to me, I'm going to get out. When I go back home, my whole family drinks. All my friends drink. Where I work, there's alcohol. They know they're going to be surrounded by it. We were talking in our, we have one AA meeting for state inmates. And I graciously got Jacob's number for a young man that has been coming to that group that's going to be getting out shortly. And he expressed those very things. And they, you know, they need that support so much, and to learn about the program and find out that they're going to go to meetings and that they're going to find other Native Americans at the meetings. They're not, you know, going to feel alone, and they will have the support that they need. If you live in this area and could possibly volunteer, I have some applications that I brought with me, because I really do try to recruit everywhere that I go. It's been, you know, a long journey, as you can tell by my silver hair, from being raised in this alcoholic Anglo-Eastern family, to being out here living in a little town in the High Plains of New Mexico, and working in a penitentiary and having an AA meeting there. I mean, these are some of the components of the things I never could have guessed were going to happen to me. I went to college. I did do high school, and I went to college and squeaked through by the skin of my teeth, because I really majored in drinking, partying, and bridge. And so my grades were a little iffy right down to the last second, but I did manage to get a high school diploma, or college diploma. And I also, by the end of college, had acquired a full-blown duodenal ulcer at 21 years old through the use and abuse of alcohol. And no one ever asked me about my drinking, because I went to the same doctors that my father and mother went to. And so they never asked me about my drinking, and no one in those days would have thought that, you know, a nice young girl from a nice family had alcoholism or drank alcoholically. Well, I did. I had blackouts through my drinking in college. I did, you know, many crazy things that could have gotten me expelled. Kept alcohol in my room, which could have gotten me expelled. You know, really just was a mess. I was suicidally depressed throughout my senior year in college. And we had stairwells. I lived in a three-story dormitory, and we had stairwells with those open part in the middle. I used to have to walk down the stairs hugging the wall. I was so afraid I would throw myself over one of those banisters and kill myself. And I would be afraid to go open and close the window. I lived on the third floor in my room because I was afraid I would get the urge to leap out of the window. I mean, I was really seriously suicidal. Got no help at all, and got out of college and went to work for a bank in New York. It was a job that my father helped me get, and I lived at home with my parents because partly I needed a special diet, which was the way they treated ulcers in those days, and I drank lots of cream and ate lots of custard that my mother made, and I ate lots of mashed potatoes and things like that. They thought a bland diet would cure it. And interestingly, it was during that time when I was working at that bank and I wasn't drinking that I met the man that I later married. And one of the most important qualities that he had was that he was not a drinker. He was not a drinker. And I wasn't drinking. Now, he would talk about college, and he would talk about the wonderful seminars he went to and his honors work and what a great time he'd had. And I kind of didn't talk about it a whole lot. You know, about the weekends after which I had to be put into the infirmary at college because I had dry heaves that wouldn't stop, and I called it the flu. And about the, you know, the escapades I had gotten into. I didn't talk about it a whole lot, but he didn't seem to notice that. And we dated and we married. He was, very, very involved in business. He had went to graduate school and got a master's in business, and that was really what his life goal was. Was to really succeed in business, which he has done. We lived kind of that corporate life you know, the mom and the kids being together all the time and the father rarely home, and he traveled a great deal. You know, he'd be dining in Paris and we'd be at McDonald's. So when that kind of life occurs, I will tell you that a family does grow apart a great deal. And we had been married maybe about 12, 13 years, I guess, when we, I said, you know, I thought we needed marriage counseling. I was unhappy. And during that time, because he was a non-drinker, I did not drink very much. Really very little when we went out and none at home, but I would take the kids and go visit my parents 4 or 5 times a year, and when I'd go home, I could pull the stops out and drink the way I wanted to. And my parents would babysit, and I'd go out to the local bars I'd gone to as a young woman, and you know, some of the people, you know, 10 years later were sitting on the same bar stool they'd been sitting on when I left home. And I'd go back and, you know, sit down next to him and get all the scoop of what had been happening. So I would have that little outlet, and I would do my outlet drinking when I went home to my parents' house. But otherwise, I didn't really appear to have a problem with alcohol. But I will tell you, you know the place in the big book where it talks about being an alcoholic without alcohol and being restless, irritable, and discontent? That's what I was. And my daughter being here, she would give you testimony of that. I tried everything to handle this restless, irritable, and discontentness. I joined every Save the World movement that ever occurred in the 60s and in the 70s. I had them out leafleting, and I had them out carrying petitions, and kept card files on people that we were trying to convince of something. I don't know. I joined every religious movement. I've been saved several times. I was trying to find what would help with this illness that only showed the alcohol symptom once in a while when I went to see my parents. But the other symptoms were there. And it kicked me around all those years. And I didn't know what its name was, and I didn't know what kind of help I could get for it. I knew I was crazy, but I tried to hide it the best I could. And I tried so hard to act normal, but I wasn't normal. Anyway, we went to a marriage counselor, and in that marital group, one of the things that I most complained about was that we did not sit down and talk together. You've got to admit, if you've got a spouse that's restless, irritable, and discontent, you might not want to come home and sit down and talk with her a lot. Now, I've given that a lot of thought. And I realized, he was justified in staying away a lot. Because I wasn't the nicest person to be with you ever met. He said one time, very candidly, that he used to come to the back kitchen door, which had glass in it, and he'd look in and try to tell by my body movements in the kitchen when I was cooking what mood I was in, so he'd know how to adjust himself before I came in the door. Because I might be, happy and feeling good and joyful. I might be kind of kittenish. I might be just loaded with fury, and I was just waiting to take it out on him. You just never knew. I wasn't stable. I was not a stable person. So anyway, during this marital therapy, I complained that we never talked together, and I said that what I wanted was, I wanted for us to be able to sit down and have cocktails before dinner like my parents had. You remember, that's the only time I talked with my parents, was when they had a drink in their hand and they were sitting down and we'd talk. So that was my idea of what family talking together and hanging out together was. There was no concept of that unless there was a glass near hand and there was alcohol in the glass. So I wanted to have a cocktail hour. And he said he didn't want to. So the psychologist said to me, look, if the point is that you want a drink or two before dinner, just make them for yourself and have drinks before dinner, before he comes home. And maybe you can talk with him later. This is a PhD, told me this. Well, I would like to tell you, the gates of alcoholism just went wide open. That was permission to drink alone. I had never had permission to drink alone. My parents' rules were you never drank alone. You always had somebody else with you. So I started to drink alone. And I will tell you, from that permission, it was about a 5-year greased slide into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, that one drink turned into two drinks, turned into three drinks, turned into, I did supper, I had drinks after supper. It just grew and grew, turned into finding the women I could, quote, go out to lunch with and drink at noon. Finding the friends that I could visit at their house in an afternoon, and we'd split a friendly gallon of wine together while we were solving the problems of the world. I'm happy to say that that friend has been in the program for years, but she and I would get into such philosophical talks. And just, I began looking for more and more and more and more occasions to drink. And drink totally on my own. That's when I got into the behavior of going to four different liquor stores so that no one knew how much alcohol I was buying, where I went into the fiction of buying the wine that goes with the recipe for the guests that were in my imagination that were going to come. But then I would go to the grocery store and buy the gallon with the screw top. I never could see the point in corks. It took too long. I always got the screw top. And my drinking just escalated and escalated. I was trying to work at the time, and I don't want to tell you because, you know, this story that I have is mine only as a gift from God. It's certainly, you know, nothing from any quality of mine. I was working part-time at the time. I'm a clinical social worker by licensure and by training. And I was working at the time with the senior citizens in the town where we lived. And one of the senior citizens was having housing problems and having some insurance problems. So she came to me as the senior citizens advocate to help with this situation. And while we were talking in our interviews, she told me about how she had been actually a concert pianist in New York and had married and had children, had a big house north of New York, and had lost everything because of her drinking and had wound up in Skid Row in New York. And through a mission there, she had gotten to know about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had gotten sober in the program. And she was now in this town where we live, north of New York, and had been 8 years sober in AA, and she was very active in that group. Her name was Winston Gillespie. And Winston happened in our sessions to break the anonymity of another woman in that group who was someone that I knew because she was on my voluntary board for the program for the senior citizens. And you know, we got Winston's problem solved, and then she went on with her life, and I went on with mine, and eventually got to the point where I was that sick and tired of being so sick and tired, and I was down to about one person being really nice to me in the world, and that person was about to turn their back on me. And that caused me to go into New York to see a counselor I was seeing one day and to say to him one line, "I think I'm having a little problem with my drinking." Now, it's about round-the-clock drinking at this point. "I think I'm having a little problem with my drinking." I finally noticed it. And I noticed it because of this reaction of this one person that was being nice to me at the time. And the counselor said, "Well, if you think you're having a problem with it, maybe you should do something about it." And that was all that was said. My husband had never raised the issue of my drinking with me. I think by that time, with the problems we had had in our family, he had such blinders on, he wasn't looking at anything. Even though I know looking back, I got absolutely blasted at some very, very fancy things that we went to in New York. And he just so successfully ignored me that he never mentioned it. No one else ever mentioned it to me. I mean, my bar room was my living room and my kitchen. So I didn't have the out-of-the-house problems very much. And I didn't often drink after I had been driving, or drive after I'd been drinking, because I would be home by the time I started drinking in the late afternoon and in the evening. So I hadn't gotten picked up by the police or anything like that. That's all the counselor said. But that night, when I went home from the city where I saw this counselor, which, just as an aside, was a very important choice on my part. We were 30 minutes, we lived 30 minutes out of New York, and I went to a counselor in New York, and I made late appointments because they put the bar cars on the commuter trains at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So if I had a 3:30 appointment, and I could get to Grand Central at 4:30, and I could catch one of the trains at about 4:45, I would go to the bar car, and I could knock down 3 drinks standing in the bar car before I got back to my hometown. Then I would walk home, go in the house, and say to whoever was present, if anyone was present, "Oh, I think maybe I'll have a little drink before dinner." Pretending, you know, that I hadn't had the ones on the bar car. I mean, everything revolved around drink. Everything. So, anyway, that afternoon, after that exchange with him, I didn't go to the bar car. That's, you know, the first miracle was I said anything to anybody. The second was that I didn't go to the bar car. And I sat down in the regular car, and I thought to myself, what do you do if you have a problem with alcohol? And I'm trying to think about it. And into my mind popped an uncle that I had, my Uncle Gene, who had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in the 1950s, very early, in one of the first groups in Philadelphia. And I mean, I had seen the change. Their family life was disaster. I had seen what had happened when he got sober. And he was sane again. And my mother had 2 women friends from New York who had been treated at Towns Hospital by Dr. Silkworth and had known Bill W. and had been sober forever. And they had alluded to their drinking years, and I knew that they had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I knew, that's where you go for help. You go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got home, and I walked home, not having had a drink, and I got on the telephone to the woman whose anonymity Winston Gillespie had broken, Jeanette, the woman that was on my volunteer board for the Senior Citizens Program, and I called her up, and I said, "Marilyn, I understand that you're in Alcoholics Anonymous." Dead silence. And she knew somebody had broken her anonymity. Now, she figured I was calling her in my professional capacity and that where there was some senior citizen I wanted her to take to the AA meeting. But that wasn't it. I said, "Oh, good." I said, "I think I'm having problems with my drinking." And she said, "Would you like to go to a meeting with me tonight?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Okay, I'll pick you up at 7:15. Be out front of your house." And that was the first meeting that I ever went to. And she was my first sponsor for a year and a half. And at that meeting, it was they had a Wednesday night meeting. About maybe, 250, 300 people would be there. It was a speaker meeting. That's where they celebrated anniversaries. And this was an anniversary celebration, and I saw another woman I knew from volunteer work in the town where we lived, and she had 1 year sober. She got her 1 year check. I sobbed. I could not imagine 1 year without alcohol. I couldn't imagine it. And I thought, I don't know that I will ever be able to do that. But they took me in that group, and they just surrounded me. I got hauled off to meetings in places I have no idea where I was, to go listen to people in the group speak. You know, they would, in those days with beginners in New York, they would make speaking engagements for group members, and they would just round up all the beginners and take them to the meeting. And they would just say, "Be out front at 6:30. Be out front at 7. Meet us at the church at 7:30, and off we'd go. Get there just in the nick of time. But I got to hear story after story after story. And my whole knowledge of this illness just grew and grew and grew. That getting sober in AA does not mean that all marriages get saved, and mine was one of the ones that didn't. I'm the one that finally had to sort of shoot it in its foot and put it out of its misery. And so we separated and we subsequently divorced, and it was a very, very turbulent time. And all during that turbulent time, my daughter Anne was going through her experiences with alcohol and drugs, and my son had tremendous depression, and she had treatment, and he had treatment, and he went to Al-Anon, and she went to AA, and I went to AA. I mean, we were just, you know, using this wonderful program, all three of us, and we made it through the turbulent times. I don't know how we did sometimes. I just don't know how we did, but we had a beginner's meeting, you know, and I'd raise my hand, and I'd say, my name is Carol, and I'm an alcoholic. My daughter tried to commit suicide, and she's in a mental hospital, but I didn't take a drink today, and everything's okay, you know, because they taught me, no matter what is going on, if I didn't take a drink that day, everything was going to be okay. And by golly, it's true. It has come out okay. Anne led us out here to New Mexico. She came out here to finish college at UNM. And my son was, euphemistically, they call it between colleges. So he didn't have a job in the East, and Anne had a spare bedroom. So he came out to Albuquerque and lived with Anne and worked in Albuquerque and was here for a couple of years, went to Al-Anon before he moved to Colorado and finished college at the University of Southern Colorado. And I was fortunate enough when I moved out in 1993 that I got a job before I even moved out here. And so I had work and I settled here. I drove myself out here. I'm not sure I would ever do this again. I'm a little older and wiser now. But I rented a 24-foot diesel U-Haul truck with a carrier on the back for my car. I had never driven a truck in my life. And I hired a fellow that just got 90 days and had his celebration the night we left New York State. It was 10 o'clock at night when we took off, and because he had to go to his 90-day celebration to get his 90-day chip. Right? So we left at 10 o'clock at night, and he says to me, I'm tired and I'm going to sleep. You'll have to drive all night. So there I am. He got me to an interstate. I'm on an interstate driving a truck for the first time in my life with all my earthly goods on it. This guy snoring in the seat beside me. And I cranked up the country western stations because they keep you kind of lively and alert. And the popular song then was Mama Knows the Highway Now by heart. And that's what I drove out here to. Well, I made it out here by July 4th, and Ernest and some other friends from the Native American group were there at my apartment that the kids had rented for me. And they unloaded all of my furniture, and we had a barbecue, and I was here in New Mexico. And my new experiences started happening right away. One of the fellows received a gift of an elk roast from Terry Pecos. And he arrived at my house. I hadn't even unpacked all my pots and pans, and he said, here's an elk roast.
let's cook it and we'll have it for supper. Now, I got to tell you, in the suburbs of New York, elk is not on everyone's lips. But you know me, I found a pan, I got out the joy of cooking. It tells you how to do an elk roast. And I cooked it, and we had elk for dinner, and I had elk for the first time. And it's just been like that ever since I've been here. Just one first after another. It's been absolutely wonderful. Just wonderful. And my career has done fine, and I've gotten to work with the people that I most love to work with, which are the alcoholics. Because I've worked in settings where those have been, the people that I have seen, many of them involved with the criminal justice system, and now all of them involved with the criminal justice system. It has just been such a wonderful adventure. I do know what all my relations mean. I know what it means on the inside, and I have experienced it in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had it experienced it in the East Coast with the wonderful mix of people that you have in the East Coast in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have experienced it here with the wonderful mix of people that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous here. And I get to expand it when I've gotten to go to things like the international convention and get to meet the alcoholics from other countries. And it is just thrilling. It is absolutely thrilling. And we meet, you know, eye to eye and heart to heart. Is that my phone? Knowing that we know the worst and the best about each other right from the beginning. We know each other. We know what kind of experiences we've had. I have had experiences in my drinking years I thought could never be healed, but they have been healed. They have been healed through other alcoholic women sharing their experiences in life with me, sharing things I never knew that women could and would talk about with each other, because they sure didn't out there in the world. But women have generously shared with me, and I have gotten so much healing. And so much healing from alcoholic men who have shared their experiences and their stories. And I've learned how to see the humor in life. I remember being so shocked at one of the first meetings that I went to when a fellow talked about having been in a state mental hospital in the alcoholism unit, and how proud he felt when he was elected president of the unit, because it was the first election he had ever won in his life. And, you know, and everybody clapped. You know, I mean, I knew what he was talking about. When I got elected treasurer of my first home group, when I was 6 months sober, I broke out crying to think anybody would trust me with money. You know, now I know I got elected treasurer because no one else wanted the job, and I was the sucker newcomer. But, you know, I was so flattered. It's just amazing. And to, you know, have the joy that I have now of living here, and believe me, had I been drinking, my kids would have said, "Mom, stay on the East Coast, please don't come out here, please don't." But that they both wanted me to move out here, that my daughter wanted me to be present as her children have been born, and to be able to be with them as infants, and trust me with them as infants, that I have been included in people's family lives the way I have. It is just amazing. And such a tremendous gift. I joined an AA bowling league a few years ago. I'm not a great bowler, but I needed to have, some fun stuff in my life. And it was at the bowling league that I met my partner, Raymundo. And Raymundo has introduced me to the Spanish-speaking AA community. And I have been able to be a part of that community over the past few years. So, I know people everywhere. And there's no one in the program to whom I don't feel that relating. Just no one. And what a joy that is. From such isolation, I cannot tell you. I was once thinner. My hair was blonde. And my clothes might have been fancier. And I sat in this big house, on a cruel embroidered, wing back chair next to the fireplace with the oriental rug on the floor and my scotch beside me. And that was the sum of my life. Everything in my day, just like when I was raised, everything in my day headed toward getting to that chair and that drink. My poor children were up in their rooms, basically hiding, or with friends up in their rooms that they were getting some, nurturing from friends. They sure weren't getting it from me. And my life was that chair and that drink. The only thing that changed was that in the summer, we had a screen porch. I moved to a wicker chair and I changed my drink. On Memorial Day weekend, I changed to vodka and tonic. I mean, it's like you don't wear white shoes until Memorial Day. You don't drink vodka and tonic until Memorial Day, and I would drink it until Labor Day, and then I would switch back to scotch and the cruel chair. That was my life. Narrow, narrow, narrow. And now, broad and interesting and exciting. You never know where you're going to go. You never know who you're going to meet. You have no idea. And God has an imagination that is so much better than any one of ours. And things are planned for us that we could never have conceived of. And they are wonderful. And it can all dissolve in 1 ounce of alcohol. 1 ounce of alcohol. That's the thing I try to remember every single day. All of this that God has given me is dissolvable in 1 ounce of alcohol. Because then this disease is triggered off and I am off and running. And my life goes right back. It's just me and that drink. Me and that drink. That's it. Thank you very much this morning for letting me share with all of you part of my journey. Thank you.